The Big Story is brought to you by Scotiabank. A lot of us know that person on social media. They start posting some questionable stuff and you wonder what they're thinking. You don't really know them as hateful or racist, but man, some of these memes they're sharing. And maybe for some of them, that's where it ends. But for others, it gets deeper.
The threat was made Saturday on Twitter. This is the tweet that was sent out. It features a picture of Tony Chaplin, a guillotine, and a sign reading "White Trade Only."
And while deeper.
University of Missouri police said Wednesday they have arrested a suspect accused of making online threats against black students and faculty.
And sometimes it ends as a worst-case scenario.
Toronto police are currently investigating what they're calling an alleged hate crime. Police say two Jewish teens were assaulted and robbed not far from
Some people are hateful and racist and violent, and the data shows they've been emboldened recently. But not everybody spewing hateful rhetoric online started out that way. Many of them have been selected and indoctrinated. How does that happen? What kind of recruitment psychology is behind that? How do you know when that Facebook friend is heading down a dark path, and what do you say to them when they are? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Elisa Hadigan is a former extremist who is now a writer, a speaker, and an educator on far-right extremism. She helps deprogram some of these people who have been indoctrinated. Why don't we start with your story, which is a complex one, but maybe you could sort of tell us how you come at the problem of hate.
Well, right now I work with people who are still involved in hate groups and trying to work with organizations that are encouraging people to leave and also to prevent youth from being involved. And I know about it all firsthand because when I was 16, I was recruited into Canada's largest white supremacist group, the Heritage Front. At the time, I had come from communist Romania a few years earlier, and my family had broken up. My father died, and there was a lot of abuse in our family. Mm-hmm. And in short order, I felt lost. I didn't have a sense of belonging. I didn't have any friends. I dropped out in grade 9, and I felt like I didn't belong in Canada, like there was nothing here for me. And then one day I was watching television and I saw this guy who didn't look like a typical neo-Nazi or skinhead. He had a suit on and kind of clean cut the way they're doing
familiar.
It now. That's right. The 90s Richard Spencer, so to speak. And he was just speaking about, white pride and being proud of your European heritage and we don't hate anybody. And then they flashed a P.O. box and I wrote to that P.O. box and I was given the information of the Heritage Front in Toronto. So within, I left a voicemail on their hotline at the time, and within 24 hours, the leader at the time, Wolfgang Droge, contacted me. And basically within a month, I was so indoctrinated that I was speaking at every rally. I was cast as their poster child and doing interviews with the press, being groomed to become a leader in the neo-Nazi movement. And I was also introduced to Ernst Sandel, who for about 30 years was the world's most infamous Holocaust revisionist. And he was working with David Irving and other people in Europe to disseminate hate propaganda.
How does that happen so quickly?
It was the perfect storm that happens to a lot of young people, and it's really which unscrupulous organization and people get to you. Like, I've worked with people who have left Taliban. Like, people who join gangs, violent gangs. And the process seems to be the same. Like, you're a lost kid who is usually bullied, has some abuse. You've got what I call the ABCs of radicalization, which A stands for alienated, alone, mm-hmm. abused. B is for buddies. You need a sense of belonging. And C comes in the form of new comrades and a cause. And that's basically, it became the family I never had.
And that was in the mid-1990s?
Yeah.
When did you leave?
2 years later, it was 1993, when I realized that there was a lot of posturing about being, just another conservative group. We were trying to infiltrate the Reform Party, and so to speak. But at the same time, people were gathering weapons and preparing for the race war. And there was a lot of violence in the streets of Toronto and Ottawa at the time. Eventually I was asked to harass people who were gay and lesbian, among other people. And that's when I had to confront the fact that I was actually gay and in the closet about it myself. And That's what changed me, is realizing that I was starting to identify with the victims that they were targeting. And when I saw myself as them, I understood how I had been manipulated. And it took me a while. I, you know, attempted suicide. It was a long process, but I ended up calling an activist who I was supposed to target from the hospital.
Okay.
And she came and we talked. And I decided to turn on the Heritage Front and inform on them. And for 4 months, I gathered information that I eventually provided to the police and ended up testifying against Wolfgang and two other group leaders. They went to jail, and it was later revealed that by Bill Dunphy of the Toronto Sun, that the second leader of the Heritage Front, Grant Bristow, was a CSIS mole. So effectively, with Wolfgang in jail because of me and Bristow in hiding, that was the end of the Heritage Front.
That is a whirlwind summary of what is an incredible story. You're now using that story to sound the alarm about hate now.
I say it's a lot worse now than in the 90s when I was recruited, because I was recruited by someone who sat down next to me and gave me the literature up front. And I was still able to shut down the group by putting that person in prison. Nowadays, kids are being recruited like from 1,000, 2,000 miles away by people who they don't really know who they really are on the other side. So, and you can send these neo-Nazi leaders of Stormfront or whatever to jail, but the propaganda is still there. The memes, the conspiracy theories, it's like what I wrote in my piece in Maclean's. It's like a virus. And it's a kind of virus that the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, they're not paying attention to that sort of virus. They're more concerned about hackers or Russian trolls or whatever. But online hate has propagated to such a degree that it's inspiring people to commit real life violence. And even after they go to jail where they get shot by the police or whatever, the same stuff that inspired them, the same propaganda is still up there, infecting the new people.
So what do we do about it? Because this is where I always run into a brick wall. Like, it's to your point, it's like a hydra, right? You cut off another head and there's 20 more.
I think we need to enforce ownership of the problem and pass it on to the social media platforms. In Germany, they passed a law this year that's huge fines if they don't remove content that is deemed illegal, like hate speech and violence inducing speech within 24 hours, or they could get fines up to 50,000 euros or higher. So that is forcing...
Who gets fined? Social media platform?
The social media platform, as it should be. Because, you know, I know in my case, the problem with the trolls is they get their accounts shut down, they start a new one, they should, the social media platforms should be really looking at IPs and banning IPs rather than just accounts. And also, if they suffer the consequences of fines, I think they would look at it a different way.
Up next.
It's a matter of kind of getting past that and trying to make people understand that we're actually more alike than you know, we think. And we all want to be loved. We all want to have an opportunity for ourselves and our kids.
You can save like never before with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. And now, for a limited time, you can earn up to 3.2% interest until March 10th. You can find all the terms and conditions at scotiabank.com/MP. Talk me through the process that goes on in your head when you're trying to help somebody who is caught up in a hate group online or in real life.
Well, the bottom line is we have to all realize that it isn't as simple as saying it's them versus us, because hate comes on a continuum that starts with fear and misunderstanding. I tell people all the time, you can't punch a Nazi. That's not going to make somebody stop being racist. It'll just polarize things further. We have to engage in conversations that make us uncomfortable instead of just blocking somebody or not talking to them anymore. You have to find out when you hear, an intolerant comment, find out where it's really coming from. Because often people feel like they're uncomfortable to ask questions that they might think perhaps might be judged as xenophobic or bigoted. So they will go on an internet site where it's actually an echo chamber for this kind
right.
of hate. And they will start talking about it with people they think are friendly, but who will actually escalate their own hate. So we have to discover. We have to have those conversations with our neighbors, with our friends, with our Uncle Bob at Thanksgiving dinner. When he makes a comment about the refugees, just say, well, why are you saying that? Like, you know, so confronting it in a non-threatening way and allowing there to be the possibility of people reaching out to us. Because when I was leaving the movement, there was nothing. There were no groups or platforms or individuals where I could actually reach out to and say, hey, I'm trapped in this world that I don't feel like I belong to anymore, but there are I can't leave. It's not that easy. It's very dangerous, as it was for me, but it's also a toxic psychological process. And often these people are very vulnerable.
I feel like often when we talk about this stuff, there's an assumption that it is way worse in the United States than it is here. What's going on here?
Well, the internet doesn't have any borders, first
right.
of all. And we can see a direct parallel in escalating hate crimes in Canada since the Trump effect, as we all know what that means.
Yeah.
The emboldening of people who previously held racist beliefs, but maybe they were a little more shy about expressing them. And now they feel like, well, if the president of the United States can say the things that he does, then what the heck, I can do it too. So there's this kind of like emboldenment that's just permeated the internet, the online world, spilling on into the real world. And there really is no border, because just to put it into perspective, Cowboy is still carrying a book that I'm not going to name because I don't want to lead to sales, but was actually used as a blueprint by Timothy McVeigh for the Oklahoma bombing. And it was also used by the terrorist group, The Order, in the U.S. And no matter what I've done, I've been able to remove Ernst Sandel's books from Kobo, but they're still carrying that one book. And that's the kind of stuff that's out there all the time, like no matter what, you know.
Yeah. How do you start a dialogue? Because I think probably a lot of us, especially a lot of us who have a big community online, have seen that friend or that relative who starts making posts that lead you to think, okay, something nasty might be going on here. What do you do when you first see those posts? How do you send them a message? Do you reply to those posts? Do you denounce them? Like, I'm asking for a strategy.
I would not embarrass them publicly because that'll help them dig their heels in. I would send them a private message. And that's one of the things that one of the organizations I work with, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London, England, they've had a pilot project where they hired people 8 hours a day, you know, 6 days a week to send DMs to people on Facebook, direct messages, people who are, and that was in with the approval of Facebook, they carried out this pilot project, asking people, I noticed that you said this and that in this on this forum, you know, I'm a survivor of violence, or I was a former extremist. And this dialogue has led to a small number of people actually taking a step back and reflecting on what they've done. Not the majority,
yeah.
But it's baby steps. And so that's the point, is not punching them, not confronting them directly, but taking them backstage or talking to them in private or sending them a direct message and just asking, I noticed you said that. I don't know what's going on. Are you okay? Is something wrong? Where are you coming up with this? And engaging them in the conversation that eventually is going to most likely lead to them expressing their fear of what they're so afraid that, you know, the immigrants or George Soros or whoever it is going to do to them. Because I think we live in a world where there's less and less economic opportunities for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to look, you know, and I think we're hardwired into this caveman mentality where it's like us versus them. And we see that with sports teams, and we see that, all, you know, since the gladiator days, there's this sort of like us versus them mentality in human psyche. And it's a matter of kind of getting past that and trying to make people understand that we're actually more alike than you know, we think. And we all want to be loved. We all want to have an opportunity for ourselves and our kids. And perhaps it's not fighting with the other guy who doesn't have the same opportunities that we don't have, but maybe looking at the system that perpetuates the inequality and the injustice, that's what we need to take into account. And the problem is, in Canada, we are so bleeding polite, and we don't want to have difficult conversations. So this has allowed what I would have considered the centrist position to be co-opted by the far right. And now it seems like it's the far right who are bringing up these issues, and it's the Jordan Petersons and it's the Faith Goldies who are bringing up conversations that probably we should all be having on, not on an extremist level, but like just having these kind of conversations so that people aren't afraid and they don't go to those extremists who are the only ones they feel are actually expressing their unsaid fears.
If it's that kind of connection that's needed to sort of talk somebody back from this radicalization, and it has to be personal, that sounds like a monumental job, you know? Like, there's so much out there online that it seems like it would be impossible for all of us to sort of reach out one-on-one. And that's the thing that seems to make the difference. So who is You mentioned one pilot project. What other kinds of things are being done to try to make that happen?
Well, I was just in Montreal this last couple of days working with a group that is just unprecedented in Canada. They do such amazing work. They're called the Center for the Prevention of Radicalization Leading to Violence, and they are literally creating tools to reach into schools, educator tools. Like I was just, I contributed my personal story to a comic book so that we create counter narratives that reach young people and people who might be vulnerable to hate. So this center is phenomenal. Like they have like staff of 20 and they get municipal funding and provincial funding. And this leads me to the problem with the rest of the country.
This was going to be my next question is what responsibility do governments have here?
We don't have a combined streamlined effect. Like, for instance, you need to have corrections facilities. You need to be able to bring in like workshops into the prisons. You need to have mentoring programs, psychological counseling for people both before, during and after they exit a movement like this. You need to have programs like, say, tattoo removal or, you know, community or maybe just move somebody, because sometimes it's the neighborhood and it's the area and the friends that they have, and there might be security concerns and they need to maybe move across the country. So you need to have integrated policing, integrated community services in order to provide a counseling and referral service for families of people who are afraid that their teenagers might fly out in the night to a war-torn Middle East country. Like there's a lot of scary things happening and people don't know where to turn if they see signs of radicalization in their kid and their coworker. And there needs to be a hotline, like they have that in Quebec, but where you can call and you can discuss shifts that you've noticed in a family member and receive advice and counselors who could possibly talk to that person.
One last question I have to ask you, as you said kind of at the beginning, about why punching a Nazi doesn't do anything. What do you say to people who are Black, who are Jewish, who have been targeted by these groups, who feel like that's my only recourse? These people want to kill me.
Well, self-defense is very, very valid. And, you know, if you're in a situation where you're out there and you feel threatened, you have to fight back. That's not an issue. It's more like it cannot be a long-term solution. Like street violence, we saw that in the 30s, you know, with it just doesn't work. Ultimately, we still have to change the social media. We have to have new cyber laws. Like I know from firsthand experience going to the police, trying to report cyber harassment and hate coming at me, that nothing was done because Canada still doesn't have the proper cyber laws in place. So that's another issue that we need to deal with. Those are the things that we have to resolve.
Alisa, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Alisa Hadigan, former extremist, now working against extremism of all forms. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotiabank. You can earn up to 3.2% interest until March 10th with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. Conditions apply. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Check out some other episodes. Drop us a line. You can check us out on social media. We had a party yesterday celebrating episode number 100. Today it's back to normal, but we'd still love to hear from you at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And we are wherever you get podcasts, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Apple, wherever you want them. We're here. Please rate, review, tell your friends. The Big Story Podcast is produced by Claire Brassard. Megan Coley is our associate editor, and she is on our social media. And I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend.